This is our, I guess it's either our ninth or our tenth season of producing this program. I can't remember exactly what date we started on, but it pretty much, at this point, we'll just say that it goes back as far as the beginning of the current. We're having our 10th anniversary on January 25th or 6th. You think I would know that date by now? 6th? 4th. That's good, Seal. Anyway, so yeah, we have been very, very pleased to produce these shows with the Citizens League as our partner for this entire time. They are a wonderful organization that seeks to get all of us more involved civically and in our community and thinking about how to work positively and engaged in our community and talk to one another about issues. And thanks to the Citizens League so much for partnering with us all these years. And we're also very excited for the second year in a row that Target Corporation is on board as our corporate sponsor, in case you hadn't noticed. Thank you very much to Target. It's been a big deal. Tonight's topic is one that so many of us can relate to because many of us, I think, fall somewhere probably on the spectrum of those who are experiencing this subject right now in our lives. These days, you often hear about how we have begun a time in America that there's a generation sort of sandwiched between two other generations for whom they have to at least think of in some way, if not directly care for. First, their children who still rely on them in some way, whether it's toddlers or college graduates who are still living at home, and their parents who have entered a time in their lives when they need to be cared for, or at the very least looked after in some way, as I said. What we are reminded all the time is that this is the new normal. When the children of the baby boom start to retire and then move into their golden years, we will have a senior citizen population in America that is enormous. And so, yeah, we're starting to talk about this now, and we've been talking about it for some time, and it will really, really see it as a foreground conversation in the coming decade. Does that mean that are we happy with the situation? Are we happy with how we're addressing this issue? I think we would say pretty universally no, because we don't have a handle on this issue at all yet. In fact, it's one that I was just talking to our guests before we started tonight. Nobody knows how to talk about really openly. I should say very, very few people know how to have this conversation with their parents, with themselves, with their children. So this is a critical topic. With that, I'll introduce our guests tonight. Dorothea Harris, on the far end here, is a licensed social worker and caregiver program. I already have some fans of Dorothea on hand. She is a... all right, awesome. She is a rock star, obviously. She's a licensed social worker and caregiver program manager at Volunteers of America. She works with African-American caregivers, providing in-home or community care to an elder or family member with Alzheimer's or with equivalent challenges. She works with individual families as well as organizes support groups where families can come together to share ideas and experiences. I'll introduce all our guests, and then a collective round of applause at the end. Eric Schubert is vice. All right, for Dorothea, yay! Okay. Eric is a vice president of strategic initiatives at Ecumen. Ecumen operates a variety of senior housing options and services, from independent living communities to assisted living and long-term care, and at-home and community-based services. He is responsible for collaborating to develop and launch ideas and new products and services as well. And Gail Kvenvold, do I have that right?
Well done.
Woohoo! Yay for me. is president and CEO of Leading Age Minnesota, which she has held, a position she's held since 1989. Leading Age Minnesota is the state's largest association of aging services organizations, serving over 50,000 caregivers, more than 100,000 seniors each year, in settings across the continuum from their home to congregate housing to assisted living care centers. So A big thanks and a round of applause for all of our guests for coming tonight and being part of Policy in a Pint. So here's how this is going to work. I'll chat with our guests here for about 20 minutes, I suppose, and then we'll go out and I'll take your questions. Please be thinking of your questions. It sometimes is a little slow to start, and then they kind of tend to bunch up at the end. So I'll get to as many as I possibly can here tonight. And also, you can follow along on Twitter and put a question in there. And some of our helpful, my producer and my ersatz producer up there will send me messages as to what has come in on Twitter as well, because I don't seem to be capable of following it. Hashtag policy pint is what you want to do. I am a twidiot. I can't work it for some reason. All right, the only rule that I ask when I go out into the audience is please don't grab the microphone from me. I hold the mic. Thank you very much. Okay, so is there a story of the elderly in America? You know, like if we look back over, I don't know, a century or say, can we see an arc of how families used to live and then things changed and they changed again, perhaps leading us to where we are today? Gail, I'll start with you on that.
Well, if you look at the arc of a century or go back to the 1900, it was not at all uncommon to find seniors living with their children and their children. Multi-generational households were quite common. You contrast that today, and in our last census, we have the largest number of seniors living independently that we've ever had in a census. It probably was also more common to see seniors perhaps more integrated in the community. There were fewer nursing homes as we know them today, did not exist yet. Independent seniors housing did not exist yet. There were things we called poor farms, isn't that horrible language, for individuals who had no family with whom to live or to take care of them. So it was really quite a different picture than we have today. Services that support us living at home or that support us when we live in a congregate setting are really a phenomena that dates back to about the mid-1960s and the advent of Medicare and Medicaid here in this country.
Has the situation with regards to the African-American population been mostly the same over time, which is to say, difficult and complicated in its own special way, or has it changed in particular ways, say, in the past 100 years with regards to the experience of the senior African-American?
Yeah, well, what I'm seeing in the African-American community is that there has been a change and there has been a shift, and I'm seeing a migration actually back to where things used to be. Tradition and history just shows that African Americans have always grown up and lived in the same home. There were always, you know, the grandparents. I'm part of the generation where, you know, my family all lived together and grandparents lived right there with us. And as things changed and they went to get individual or single senior housing, it's getting real tough now. And so I'm seeing that, you know, we're having to come back together and to care for one another.
So Eric, leading, being the vice president of an organization that provides services, provides facilities and services, how does it break down, would you say, with regards to where do we find that seniors who need some kind of care or attention and are not fully independent any longer, where are they living? What percentage does it break down in America? Do you know national statistics?
So
basically, of like where they're living in homes, or living in at their own home, or you know.
The vast majority of people are living in the greater community, in their own homes. I saw a stat the other day. Harvard's has a housing and policy center, and this was really interesting to me. 2% of people in the U.S., 65 plus, are living in a group setting. So a group setting characterized as either assisted living, co-op, nursing home. So that's a that's a really small segment. The vast majority are living in a community setting. Now, one of the major issues is you have a lot of people who are living in a community setting, but they're either living with disabilities and not getting the care and services they need. They're living on a social island because they're not socially connected. They're isolated because they're not driving. They've got no connection to transportation. So, yes, people are living in the community, but what kind of quality of life is there in the community for people living mm-hmm. out there?
So, all right, there's a number of issues that we're going to talk about that are overarching issues here tonight. There is the sense of, like I said at the beginning, do we like this situation? And I think the answer more often than not is going to be we're not fully satisfied with the way things are today and which we're headed unless we start to get more of a handle on it. But also the financial aspect of it, which is, you know, how in the world have we been paying for the care when it does come to not being able to if we can't as grown children, as adult children, take care of our parents and they have to go into some sort of assisted living, how do we pay for that? We don't seem to have any kind of handle on that at all yet, and so we'll get to that. But I'm curious, as far as even broaching this subject, it seems that this is something that we have a very hard time talking about, certainly within our own families, if not collectively through the media and whatnot. I mean, talking with our parents and grandparents about what's going to happen when they can no longer live on their own is perhaps the biggest thing that we need to plan for that we absolutely are averse to talking about. Why do we have such a hard time talking about this topic?
Well, as someone who is 63, I would say we deny our age. 60 is the new 40, right? I mean, that's what we say. I think we boomers are perhaps more guilty of that than almost any generation yet. We associate aging with loss, and we don't like talking about loss. We don't like about talking about our ability to not drive any longer, or are needing to downsize our homes, or leave our communities. Those are painful topics that we would choose to avoid for as long as we can. And it's not just with our parents. I think it's in our own lives. Eric, before we began, asked the question, how much thought have we given ourselves to how we want to live as we age? We just assume that we're going to be able to have a whole bunch of choices before us. And
you mean you guys?
One,
you
yeah,
three?
We three.
Yeah.
We assume it.
Yeah.
We don't just assume it. We don't assume it will just be difficult for our parents. It's difficult for us, too.
So it's difficult for you guys to even talk about it. Dorothea, were you?
Well, I was just going to say life is good. Who wants to talk about aging and dying?
And you guys, it's like your job to think about this and talk about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's easier to talk about it with others that are in crisis and are going through it because that's our profession. But to think about it ourselves, yeah, well, I'm in denial.
Wow. And this is your
ditto.
Experience as well.
Ditto, yeah. I don't wake up in the morning thinking about cognitive or physical disability and death.
Okay, so that leads to the next question. When do people start dealing with it?
When they're in crisis. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's been my experience over the years. It isn't until it's right there in front of us. And
is that the universal?
We can't avoid it.
Pretty
yes.
much?
Yes.
When they're in crisis. Okay. Well, it's certainly my experience, and I would imagine a lot of people here would say as well. I mean, because we don't know how to talk about it. I mean, heck, in my family, we don't know how to talk about money at all, and I don't know. I come from a particularly conservative family, and the interesting thing that I find is that my wife's family is very open, very liberal. They don't. I mean, which is to say, they're happy to discuss things. They're happy to try to be honest about things, not be in denial about things. They have no idea how to talk about this. It is the biggest taboo subject, I think, bar none. Quite frankly, is what's going to happen when we can no longer take care of ourselves. Okay, so when the crisis comes, what happens? What are the various scenarios that play out?
I would say that, you know, that's when you start going down the caregiver journey. And depending on what the crisis is, that's when you would pull in the services and the supports and the family meetings and networking with agencies and finding out what is it going to take to get this family back to stability or to a place where they can do the caregiving. You know, it's either in the home or if you need to look for placement outside the home, that's when the wheels get to rolling.
Yeah, go ahead.
Something we didn't really cover yet, but I think it's important to think about in terms of both the, what happens when the crisis comes and how is aging different today than it may have been decades ago. Most of the support that seniors receive are provided by their family members, not by organizations like the ones I represent or Acumen or Volunteers of America. It's actually sons and daughters. It's still mostly daughters and daughters-in-law, and they provide care and support. So before the crisis even occurs, more often than not, there's a family member who's seeing something happen that would be an opportunity to intervene earlier when you aren't so desperate to make a decision or feel so panicked about making a decision. And fortunately, one of the ways aging is different is there are some really good resources out there today. There is a one-stop shop. There's the Senior Linkage Line here in Minnesota, minnesotahelp.info. Those are places that you can go either in crisis or hopefully well before there's a crisis as you see changes. One of the things we talk about very often is that there's a flurry of admissions to assisted living and care centers that follows Thanksgiving time or Christmas time because the adult kids come home, realize mom and dad aren't functioning like they were, and that some, quote, something's got to be done.
People start Googling it or whatever.
Exactly.
They start going there.
Exactly.
All right. Is there, other than pure denial, is there like a specific set of misconceptions that people have about how things are going to go for them or for their parents?
Misconceptions? You know, I think in some cases, well, in a number of cases, there's this weird dynamic that happens when you're the child and your parent has an issue, and all of a sudden you're the caretaker or you're the navigator for the person trying to be proactive and help them out, and so the roles kind of switch. And I think psychologically, oftentimes that can be kind of a weird dynamic.
What are the particular unique difficulties faced by the African American population? I was reading somewhere that dementia is particularly high in African American populations. Alzheimer's is particularly high?
Yeah, we're certainly seeing that those new statistics that are coming out that African Americans are at a higher risk for dementia than the other populations. And primarily it has to do with our health disparities. We're on the top of the list. We're at the highest risk for strokes and diabetes and heart attacks and all of those things. And of course, those things would be risks for brain diseases. And so that's where we see that. But I wanted to say a little bit more about African American families wanting to stay at home and be in the community more so than other populations. And, you know, a lot of that has to do with just slavery and discrimination and racism. They're not wanting to be out in the mainstream without having their family members there. And so I've certainly worked with many elders that would rather stay home, you know, regardless of what's going on, how sick, what the diagnosis are. They want to be at home with their family. They're more comfortable being at home with their family. And so I do a lot of work around that, how to make the house safe and accessible, how to get family members together. Everybody can't. I mean, one person can't do everything, but, you know, how to work together again to be that family that sticks together.
Now, does that mean that there is, even when living with other family members mm-hmm. is not always an option, there's more of a hesitation to move into some sort of facility simply because of that inherited mistrust and suspicion?
Oh, absolutely.
Even if it means being just independent, well, quote-unquote independent, staying alone.
Absolutely. I think that because of the mistrust in the healthcare facilities that continues to linger with African Americans, they're feeling unsafe and, you know, maybe exploited at some time. And, you know, when you get to be an older senior, that's actually unhealthy. You know, they're more stressful.
You know, Steve, you asked about misconceptions, and I think a big one is, you know, when we go to the physician and let's say you have a herniated disc, well, your general practice physician is going to send you to go get an MRI, and then from there you may go see a surgeon or you may go through physical therapy. And when you're hit with a diagnosis of multiple chronic illnesses and a loved one is maybe having cognitive issues as well, there's not that integrated kind of flow that you go through. It's, okay, well, I think you need to start figuring it out. You know, maybe you should look into home care or look into at Ekman we call it the F word, facility. It's such a cold word.
But it is.
It is.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, kind of sterile. Yeah.
Because we have, my gosh, we have there's been movies portraying it as horror stories. There have been experiences we've all had of going in. And even in the nicest facilities in the world, my grandfather was in a facility years ago, and this was a pretty posh place. Yeah. And there was still the experience of people clearly suffering, disoriented, very, very unhappy. And so we have a lot of accrued fear of the facility.
And that's why I love this discussion, because if half this room stood up right now, that's half of this room is likely to have dementia at some point. So this issue becomes extremely personal. It also impacts every part from community planning to financial planning to healthcare.
Okay, so let's get to the financial issue here. I'm going to go out and take your questions here in a few minutes, but we've taken this, we had this long wind-up basically to the financial issues surrounding this. So how much do all these various scenarios cost? Do we have this continuing from something that borders on independence where there is some kind of help coming into the home to help with mom or dad or mom and dad, all the way to full-on nursing home care? We would think that the expenses rise in that direction, and I'm sure they do, but give us an idea of what we're talking about.
Well, it is going to depend upon how much care and support you need, and you're right about the direction of expenditures. If you're relying on home care and you need some care and support, let's say you need 4 days a week or so with someone coming in, you're probably going to spend about $4,000 a month on average for that support. That's somebody coming into the home on a regular basis and providing, I think it runs about probably $35 a visit, depending upon what that person is doing for you in that setting.
Is that a national average?
That's actually a Minnesota number. National average is probably going to be a little bit higher.
Okay.
If you go to assisted living, which to define it, it usually is apartment-style living with an overlay of services, you're going to jump a little bit in cost, although you're probably about $4,500 a month. It's going to, again, depend upon how much support you need on a day-to-day basis. If you go to 24-hour skilled nursing care, you're going to jump to about $6,500 a month. There will be a variation on that depending upon whether or not you want a private room. I think it's bizarre to think of sharing your room with a stranger. I don't think there is such a thing as a semi-private room. A room is either private or it's not, but it will cost you more. Nationally, the number is going to be about 90,000 a year. Here in Minnesota, it's going to average out at about 78,000 a year.
Everybody's saving for this now, right?
Right.
You got a specific savings account for all of this. Okay, so now how is it actually paid for? These are raw numbers. Right. How is it actually paid for, though? How do most people pay for it? Cash?
Out of their own pocket.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is the other thing I was wondering about, misconceptions. It's like, well, surely when I retire, the stuff that I have saved for my retirement, I'm going to have enough left over to pay for this, or some sort of long-term care insurance is going to help pay for this, or Medicare is going to pay for this, or Medicaid. How does it work? No?
Well, and you just hit on the big misconception, because if you ask most boomers, and numerous surveys have, how are baby boomers, our biggest bulge of people who have seniority next, how are they going to pay for this kind of services we're talking about? And they say Medicare. Well, Medicare's not going to pay for that. It's going to pay for 90 days maybe in a rehab center after I have a hip replacement, but it's not going to pay for that long-term services and supports that we're talking about.
90 days.
So 90 days. So let's say you're living with dementia for 20 years. Well, you know, at the numbers Gail is talking about, it doesn't take long to wipe someone out financially. So where are most Minnesotans and Americans? How do they pay? They use what's called Medicaid, which basically means they've become impoverished and the state is paying for them, which limits options significantly. And if seriously, you can't make it up. If you were designing a system today, that wouldn't be the way. If we sat down with papers and napkins right now, we would not design it like this. That we'd go into poverty.
And just to frame that a little bit, so about 7 out of 10 people over the age of 65 will have a need for some service, long-term care service or support over the course of their lifetime. But about 20% of that 70% will need it for 5 years or more. So again, to do the math, as Eric was suggesting, for that group, it's really kind of catastrophic expense in terms of what most of us have available to cover our costs. Now, the good news is 30% aren't going to have a need for long-term care services and supports. But realistically, the longer you live, the more likely it is that you're going to have to tap into that support system.
Wait a minute. The good news is they won't have a need for that because they won't live as long?
No, because they're going to actually live without requiring that support.
Okay, thank you for clearing that up for me. Okay, yeah. So I was going to say that's a rather twisted good news. So, all right, so basically you're exhausting your savings so you can go on Medicaid. Awesome. Okay. Now, are there are things different for different socioeconomic groups? I kind of see how things are. I'm beginning to have an understanding of the specific difficulties faced by African Americans. But is there specific scenarios that we find Asian Americans falling into, or anything like that?
I don't know that, but tying it back to health. When we look at people and chronic illness, if you're not taking care, if you're not in good health in younger age, chances are you may not make it to old age, or you're going to be living much longer with chronic illnesses, which again, multiple chronic illnesses. So this all interconnects to how we live, how we age, and how we die.
How will boomers be able to? Well, first, how will things automatically be different for retiring baby boomers by nature of particular situations that I can't imagine yet? And secondly, how will it be different because they will force a change? Will the massive volume of boomer retirement find us in a situation where change will just be able to be pushed for on a massive scale, whereas it wasn't before, do we think? Let's just start with how it's going to be paid for.
Well, if you look at what we spend as a state in medical assistance today, and you trended that forward with no change, we would break the bank. By 2020, we'll have more people over 65 than we have school-aged children. So eventually, we would end up competing with various with kids for care for seniors, unless we find a better way to pay for this care. I mean, that's one way it'll force change. The other thing that would be top of mind for me is we could have called this evening, Who Will Care for Mom? Because the flip side of the aging number of boomers is that we aren't replacing them in the workforce in the same numbers, anywhere close to the same numbers. And there are actually beginning to be, in many parts of our state, pretty extreme shortages of people who do the direct services to care for mom.
Wow. So there'll be even more of an imbalance. Dorothea, so we have a question that came in on Twitter that relates to, I want to jump back to something you were talking about earlier, which is the mistrust, the prejudice against facilities towards reaching out for care, is it warranted? Is the suspicions in the African-American community about what they may experience based on experience?
Well, you know, when we're talking about the senior population, you know, no doubt they have experienced some of that. And so if it's real to them, it's real. And so if they're feeling like, you know, they don't want to be in that type of setting, and it's just kind of a tradition. Most African Americans come from a Christian background, and you know, the belief is you care for your parents, you respect your elders, you make sure that they're in being taken care of. And so that's kind of a duty, a moral duty that African Americans as well as minorities try to uphold to. I mean, I've actually worked with seniors that, you know, they are not going.
what I'm wondering, and I don't know that this was addressed in the question, but I'll fill it in, and that is that, is there evidence showing that African Americans going into a care setting actually do receive care, which is...
Oh, I'm sure, absolutely, I'm sure. And now we're having more settings that are in the community. We have Heritage Center, Thomas Finney, and it's in North Minneapolis. And so seniors can feel like they're going to be with their neighbors and church friends and, you know, feel a lot more comfortable in a setting like that. So, yes, we are seeing change for sure.
Okay, before I take this question, what is that? I'm over here. What was the...
It's the Thomas Finney Manor. We have some housing in North Minneapolis. We've got the Senior Center. We've got the State of the Arc over there where African Americans are feeling comfortable right there in their community where they're seeing people that look just like them and feeling more comfortable.
So this is something that has evolved organically. This is.
I think it was intentionally, you know, where it's located.
Okay, I see what you're saying now. But earlier we were talking about communities that were coming together and, jump in on that.
Yeah, Gail. So we were talking earlier about what's called now in the United States the Village Movement. And what it essentially is...
Can you hold your mic just a little closer? There you go.
Is seniors deciding that rather than move to a facility, they're going to create a virtual retirement community in the neighborhood where they already live and where they want to stay. And it's a concept that was born in Boston and the Beacon Hill area, and a group of aging persons who were neighbors to one another said, look, let's get together and broker fees with one home health agency and somebody who will shovel our walks and somebody who will do our maintenance, and we can hire a service coordinator together and we can stay here in our neighborhood with the people that we've lived with all of our lives. And what's happened over the years is you see other communities trying to replicate that model of creating the virtual retirement community. Ecumen has done some innovative work around the Village Movement.
Yeah, we worked with a group of neighbors down in Minneapolis that wanted to do that and have done that. The interesting part is that people who live in that community and who have been caregivers to a spouse and or anticipate doing that have said they've really would like a building there where that they could live in and have the services in the building. So we are, next year we'll be breaking ground. We anticipate breaking ground on a building right near McPhail for that very area. It's, Steve, you mentioned a question earlier about disparities. And I think people who have great assets, great financial means, will be able to afford what I'd call concierge care.
Yeah, right.
But the part that I think all of us worry about tremendously is the vast middle group. You know, ideally, and I think this impacts Medicaid, the safety net that we talked about earlier. Medicaid was built to be a safety net, to be there for people who could not escape poverty. And increasingly, with Medicaid becoming the insurance product for many Minnesotans and for many Americans, that, is, as Gail pointed out earlier, takes money away from other areas. And so, you know, there's this vast group of people in the middle that will just don't have the assets to self-insure, but will move very quickly to Medicaid. So that's a huge public policy issue.
Right. I saw something in the New York Times yesterday about how the new the second new income gap is not between like the 1% and the 99%, but the 1% and the 0.5%, like the super wealthy and the super duper 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 wealthy.
Yeah.
All right, our first question here.
I have a question back to the mistrust issue. How do you address the mistrust? Like, how do you help your maybe aging parents understand, or people who have a mistrust of this assisted living, that it might actually be better for them? Like, what sort of things do you find that you can bring up to make them more comfortable? And secondarily, like, I have parents who are not necessarily from this country, you know, so they may have cultural issues as far as assisted living, and there may be other, you know, people that have that same issue. How do you make them comfortable and let make them understand that it might not be something that's to be feared?
Well, a couple of things. One is that things are changing, and I see that a lot of the different cultures, of course, migrate together. And so there's a senior building downtown Minneapolis where a lot of the Russians have migrated together, Somalis. And so that is one thing that a new person would want to see, that it's not as not as clear black and white as they known it to be, and then to go visit and to see. And then, of course, other seniors are going places, so word of mouth. So there's a little research that needs to be done around that, and then bringing that back to the elder and being more open and receptive to how they take that.
And I got to give the props to the people who do the direct service right with customers. If the best people in this profession are saints, and what I, in to your question, what they really work to do is how do they, what's important to the person that's entrusted their lives to us, culturally, spiritually, vocationally, and in that living environment, how do we help support that person to ensure they're enjoying life where they're living? And that's different ways for different people. And I've been fortunate to have as colleagues people who it's a calling for them. And you can see they do these forms, and they're long biographical sheets learning about the person and what do they love doing, what did they love doing if they're not doing it anymore. And even in the throes of dementia, there are ways that that you can connect with a person, empower them, honor them, engage with them. And I'm not the pro that does that, but the people who do it are invaluable. And that's the kind of people you want to find. And the way you were talking about the interviews and in other ways, talking to other family members that haven't experienced, those are kind of have to put on that investigation hat.
Next question here.
So I'd like to reframe the discussion a little bit. We are currently spending hundreds of billions of dollars on long-term care that nobody wants. Nobody designed the long-term care system. It gradually evolved with very poor planning in response to various kinds of crises. When we go out and ask people what they want, it's pretty clear that they want autonomy, they want dignity, they want respect, they want to be able to make choices, and none of that is going to be provided in an institutional setting. And so the question I think that we have to struggle with now with people in this room is, if the baby boomers are truly going to improve life for themselves, they're going to have to do it now for their parents. Because by the time they get to be old and frail, they're going to have lost their power. And the issue is, can we reimagine a long-term care system that actually gives people what they want rather than what's foisted upon them? And I think we spend a huge amount of time apologizing for a status quo that we'd all like to tear down and redo. And the question is, how do we get about that business?
I'm going to point to one thing, and that's a big chunk of that is financing. I mean, Dr. Kane, thanks for coming, and Rosalie, thanks for coming, and thanks for all your work. The Canes, for you don't know, are...
Can you introduce our guest here?
Just introduce yourselves from the university.
Forgive me for not recognizing you and not knowing who you were, so...
Share your book that you recently wrote. Just share the name of it for the crowd here.
Well, the book I think you're talking about is The Good Caregiver,
right?
Which is a survival guide for caregivers to basically try and deal with this system that is unresponsive. And it's built largely on my own experience trying to take care of my mother. I mean, I've been in, you know, doing this kind of work for 40 years and know a little bit about it, know most of the people in the country who are doing it, and I couldn't get the system to work for her. Now, I would argue that if somebody, you know, who's an experienced, you know, caregiver working with a devoted daughter, my sister, couldn't get the system to work, the system is broken. And I think we have to start with that. So anyway, I'm Bob Kane. I teach at the University of Minnesota and do research in long-term care. Rosalie Kane is my wife, is a social worker, and she also does the same kind of research that I do. And we've committed ourselves to really trying to change the long-term care system fundamentally.
Thank you both for being here tonight. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Rosalie, did you want to say something as well?
Robert is a physician. He mentioned my profession. I wanted to say, from my own experience, and I'm 74, my dad just died a couple years ago at 102, I had the experience of a system in Canada which did not impoverish people at the point that they needed long-term supportive services. They paid a hefty copay, but there was a kind of a universal entitlement to some basic services, and it made a huge difference, so I'm hoping we can get there that way.
All right. Please.
Bob put out a provocative challenge about how do we reimagine this and then do something about it, and Eric mentioned financing, and certainly financing reform is a big part of this, but Bob, where I thought you'd go is about engaging the public in this debate, this dialogue we're having here tonight. I'm delighted to see this room full, but the truth of the matter is that the public is not as engaged on this issue of who will care for mom as they might be on some other issues. How do we capture the hearts and minds of people who are outside of this room tonight in ways that really move the dial on change?
You tell me, what are your ideas?
I think, frankly, part of it is around public information. Where our organization is launching a public information campaign in January that's about how do we want to live as we age? What is it we want for ourselves? What is it we want for our parents? and open that dialogue that we were talking about at the very beginning this evening.
I want to add on to that. I think it's also, you know, bringing that dialogue and engaging people. So Gail was talking earlier about the majority of people who are caregivers are holding down a full-time job while they're trying to provide care for a loved one. Well, that's H-E double hockey sticks. I mean, that is, and so...
You're not Minnesotan.
Yeah. So, but I don't think as a society and as businesses, we've really looked at what kind of impact does that have on workers? What kind of impact does that have on the family that's trying to cobble together that care? It is that's a mess. And so this discussion it ties to businesses. It ties to multi-generational wealth. It ties to how we want to live in communities. It touches every area. And I think we need to bring that discussion to people, just like today. There's all different ages here, backgrounds, et cetera. This discussion needs to go out.
All right, our next question.
It seems like there's the biggest stat that struck me is the relatively small percentage of people who get the care that they need later in life, whether that's due to a personal desire or bias against a more managed care situation, or whether it's due to just a lack of ability to pay for it. And it seems to me like you either have two options. You increase the ability of families and communities to help people receive better care where they're at, or you somehow change or convince people or give them the resources they need to go to situations where they're located with closer to other seniors who are receiving certain services. So if you think about those two directions, which of those two moves do you think is the larger piece of the solution of where we need to be going? Is it more about giving families that are providing care and communities, coaching them up so they provide better care and at a lower cost themselves? Or is it about changing mindsets around what communal living as a senior might look like?
I don't think it's either or. I think it's both. If you go back to the fact that most of the care seniors receive right now is provided by families, it's incumbent upon us to do everything we can to extend and increase their abilities to continue to provide care. Families are smaller. They're more geographically dispersed than they were. In Minnesota, we have the highest number of women who are also employed outside the home. There are a lot of things that work against family caregiving in that sense. So I think that is certainly an area we need to invest in. But I would also say, and you know, we're here in downtown St. Paul tonight, but we kind of have a tale of two states. If you go out to greater Minnesota, the answer probably is going to be more about congregating. There probably will be parts of our state where there will be such a shortage of caregivers as we go forward that our ability to have people congregate to receive care and still maintain those qualities of I'm in control, I make choices, my life has purpose, my life has meaning. I don't think that the two together are impossible. But I would say both are equally important, both of the directions that you pointed out.
All right, our next question.
I have a question about assisted living. I think it's become a euphemism for people, and there was the horror story a couple years ago about the woman in California who choked on food during her lunch, and the staff person at the facility was not allowed by California state law just to give her CPR. And there was a front line a couple years ago that said a huge number of people in assisted living facilities actually should be in nursing homes. Are there state laws in Minnesota that define what assisted living is and the care that can or cannot be given to those people?
You want me to tackle that? The answer to your question is a yes and a no. Yes, there is state law in Minnesota that defines what assisted living is, And it is regulated through our home care rule here in the state. But what we have not done in Minnesota is something many states have done. I actually think it was the right decision for our state. We haven't said that if you have XYZ characteristics and care needs, you have to be in a nursing home. You can't be here in assisted living. We've basically said, as long as you feel that you can be cared for safely and securely in an assisted living setting, and the provider of that service agrees, you can stay in that setting if you choose to do so. My personal feeling is that's what I want for myself. I want to be able to make that decision, but with it does come risk. And one of the interesting and very important conversations we have is about balancing safety and risk. And what we often see is that a family member will place a greater emphasis on safety than the older person, him or herself. We may want to take the risk. Our family, our daughter, might want us to be safe. And that's going to vary for every person in almost every circumstance.
I think we can safely go to about quarter past here. The bar is still open, don't forget that, so the Amsterdam would love for you to take advantage of that. And also, I'm going to get to a few questions in the back. I've promised a few people here that I would get to them, but I don't want you to think that I'm ignoring you back there. So as soon as I answer two more questions up here, I'm going to spend a little time back there, get some more questions. So I'm going to be back there shortly.
Hi. So I've spent less time focusing on the policy and the finances because I'm a caregiver, and we live in a three-generation home in our home that we just moved to a couple years ago. So my question is, I feel like there's more people moving to a multi-generational family than there have been in the past. I feel like I'm not as alone as I was a few years ago. And then 2 points. First of all, I'd love to get a copy of that caretaker book. That would be really great. And also, from a systems perspective, the advice that I have gotten and that I take to heart is that it really is a system, and there's a learning curve. And I wish so much that there was an advocate or a navigator, somebody that I could have talked to about how to keep track of the different doctors and the different tests and the different clinics and the different prescriptions and who prescribes what and who can fill what prescriptions. And then lastly, and then I'll stop talking. Gail had...
No more questions. I'm just joking. Just joking. Sorry, teasing you.
No, that's fine. Go.
No, it was a joke. I'm sorry.
Gail had talked about changing the framework, and one of the things that I've found in our family is that we are really trying to honor the aging and dying process and really trying to remember and focus on all of the assets and all of the richness that my mother-in-law brings to our household. And I don't see that as a culture. I don't think that we really value what our aging population brings to our communities. And I see that both in the aging population and in the people that are caring for them, grandchildren, children, what have you. And so I would love to have that conversation and to hear more emphasis put on valuing those gifts that they're giving to us.
You're here.
So, you know, the last part about the gifts, I think that's really what the profession that we are all involved with is really about. Because if we're providing great service, great care, we're engaging those gifts. We're honoring that person. And I gotta say, we're talking about southwestern Minnesota, but you can go into any part of Minnesota, and you can go into what we'll call senior living communities, and you will find people having fun. I mean, living life to the fullest. Now, I personally sit here and say, well, I'd like to live in my home when I get to be that age. But there's a lot of people that live in these communities and absolutely love it and wouldn't change it for anything. And I'd say that the ones that are the best at it are doing the types of things that you're doing with your loved one, and that's all about honor. And you know, back to Gail's point, southwestern Minnesota, you know, they've been dealing with the age wave or the changing demographics for some time. And one of the ways dealing with that is congregate housing. That's absolutely essential. I had another thought there, and I might come back to it, but I just completely lost it. It was really good.
So Dorothea?
How many of us are going to have dementia at what age and time?
Yeah, right.
Oh, boy, we got to be careful. I was just going to comment on the last part as well. I'm just a real strong believer in faith community living as long as possible. I mean, sometimes it's inevitable that you have to move up the ladder and go through some of the other services. I'm a caregiver, and I care for my grandmother, who's 96 years old, and it's just an honor and a pleasure to be able to do that, tap into, you know, adult day, PCA services. We'll do that for as long as we can. We're able to work it, and it's working real well. And then you move on. So I think that as many and those that can, you know, that would be the way to start. And then to begin to look, educate yourself ahead of time so you know where you're moving to. But, you know, those that can do that, that would be awesome. And the other thought I was thinking of is now when I meet with my friends and my inner circle group, our plan is to buy a house over on Summit somewhere, some kind of mansion or something, and we will all live there, and we will hire services and people
awesome.
To come in and care for us. So we're thinking of that village ourselves.
Virtual community.
Virtual community. Again, I'm going to get to questions in the back. I promised one more up here before I spend a little time back there. We can go a little longer, actually, than I had originally thought. So we have more questions here than I've seen in a while.
Do you provide the round?
The round, I would love to, but I'm on a nonprofit salary, so I can't quite do that. But it's a nice idea. Did we get the, somebody mentioned interest in the book that the professor wrote. Did we get information on that on Twitter so people can follow it? Okay, so again, hashtag PolicyPint is where you will find that. And a couple things. One that I think of is, you know, how it's already sort of the thing to talk for younger generations to talk about how obnoxious baby boomers are, and they you know, they can't stand listening to the "In My Days" from baby boomers and everything. But if it would be, it's such a tragedy that we don't honor our seniors, and you know, there's been generations in this culture where we don't do that. We shunt them off somewhere else. We don't want to have them as part of our living situations. We've got to see this change. We've got to see this as a cultural change, don't you think? That we don't, you know, put our senior citizens behind walls, you know. And the reason that I tie up the thing, I tie it together with baby boomers is because, so, are baby boomers going to be able to force this change because they are such a large number of people, or will it be seen as, oh, well, the baby boomers are going on and on about how they want to be cool and honored and part of the family, but we hate those baby boomers anyway, and we just are so tired of listening to them. You know, this is something that I see coming down the pike already, and I worry about. But that's not a question, and it was way too long and crazy.
Well, if I could comment, and I would point out that earlier, Eric referred to the baby boomers as the bulge when he was talking about us, and I think that's probably an apt description demographically. But, you know, I would say a couple of things. One is, boomers do vote. If you look at the most recent election in Minnesota, their boomers got out and voted. And to the extent that public policy can be moved by showing up at the polls, I think they're a force for change. The other thing I would say is that the boomers have a lot of conversation among themselves about what their encore will be. They're not looking at retirement as the hard stop, let's go to Arizona and play golf every day. We're trying to figure out how we can continue to be contributing, dynamic, interesting parts of our society in ways that give back. And by our actions, you will know us. We will be contributing to the quality of life in our state. And that, in turn, I think, will help change attitudes about aging. So I think there's a really positive movement afoot in the boomer community itself. There's a group called the Vital Aging Network, and these are, by and large, retirees, if I can use that language, who are out there giving back in a whole lot of dynamic ways.
So maybe at some point it'll become something that it'll be cool to hang out with your grandparents, and you know.
Maybe.
I see your hand there, and I'm going to come back to you. You can actually rest it. So I promise, and she'll remind me about it too. So I'll come back as soon as I can. All right, next question. She's been waiting a while.
That's great. As someone who's hoping to take in my elders into our home, what's the what can we be planning for? What can we start now to help ease that process of them coming into our home for care?
You know,
ease
I think
it for them, do you mean? Or ease it for everyone?
For everyone.
First of all, salute for wanting to do that. And I think a big part of it is if you can, have a conversation about what, if you're able to do this on the front end, about what you both want it to be like. And that may involve engaging some other people, because it's really hard work. But it could be an extremely rewarding experience. And so I think that talking and laying out expectations is key if you can do that.
And I would say familiarize yourself with resources in your community where you are. And there are a couple of places you could go to check that out. There's an area agency on aging in every region of the state. Good place to go for resources. Take a look at MinnesotaHelp.info, again, for a listing of resources. Check out, don't think you're alone in supporting that senior loved one in your home. There are lots of ways and lots of people in your community around you who will help you make that successful for you and for the family member as well.
There, you go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, I really like the idea of asking for help and also letting your inner circle know that that's what you'll be doing, that you'll get the support that you need. I think that Minnesota is one of the number one places for growing older, for seniors to live. We have so many so many services and so many ways that you can tap into things for elder care.
There's also literature that's even already here for you to check out on your way out, because we have a literature from the Citizens League on this table back here, but also next to it is some stuff that even pertains to this very topic, so you can check that out too. All right, our next question, and I'm sorry, folks, that I've left you with your arms up in the air for so long back here.
Thank you for being here tonight. One of the challenges is that lifestyle contributes to someone's later health. So how, as individual and community, can we work together to have better health outcomes by having the social determinants of health, housing, transit, jobs, education, food, parks, et cetera, improved? The second question is, what about people who have no spouse, partner, or children?
You just hit two major issues, and I think one is on community development. We're going to have to very quickly think about community design differently. And so, you know, for example, in St. Paul, you know, so St. Paul, can this be a place that's really helpful for aging? I mean, you've got the YMCA downtown, you've got the health centers, you have light rail, yet there's pretty limited senior housing downtown here. And, you know, let's not, if we're going to build, to your other question about if you're a single person living at home, that's part of community planning too. How do we have the services in the community that are easy to access, and prepare for an aging population and not just leave people as orphans in their homes. So I think the idea of community development, that discussion really needs to get deeper and wider rather than well, we're going to build an assisted living community out in the suburb, you know, out near the highway, because that's where it's zoned for, not near anything. That's not going to cut it.
You know, there's a movement called Communities for a Lifetime, and it's exactly what Eric is referencing. It's a look at how we plan and design our communities in ways that make them places that are not just good places to grow up, but good places to grow old. And it's simple things like, do you have sidewalks so that when people can no longer drive, you can walk to where you need to get? Or you mentioned transportation, that every year our state does, or I think it's every 2 years, Larray over here would know, does a gaps analysis to look at what's missing in our services that support seniors being independent. And year after year, transportation comes back as one of the key issues. So that's a key part of design. And, you know, to the question of I don't have a spouse or I don't have children, what lies ahead for me? You know, I would say, as someone who doesn't have kids, in addition to investing heavily in my nieces and nephews over the years, it is truly about planning ahead. Some of the literature that's at the back, and I'd be remiss if I didn't mention this, is a statewide initiative called Own Your Future. Larray, who I referenced over here, Kanataroot, is the key person who's been working on that. And it's about thinking ahead when we are in our 30s and our 40s about how we want to live when we're in our 80s and 90s. And those of us who plan ahead are going to have more choices, and we're not going to feel as panicked if we don't have the daughter next door or the spouse who lives to the same great age we live to. It's all about owning our future, and that's the name of the initiative.
Yep. I was just thinking about the initiative on the Act on Alzheimer's, and because we know that we're going to be seeing a lot of dementia, and how to make communities dementia friendly. And so it's on the same plane of getting ready for that, because we know that we're going to see a big wave of that. And then in regards to not having family, you know, seniors have lived on the planet a long time. And if it's not direct family, there are extended families, whether it be nieces or nephews or whatever. So we never want to put that out. And the other thought is I have to give a plug for my co-workers, Anita Raymond and Joyce Konchek, because they are the best care managers that I know. And it would really be... it would behoove anyone that wanted to get a jump on things and to know what services, what can be done, to take a look at a care manager. Take a look at those two, of course. But take a look at a care manager service where you can have someone to actually come in and do an assessment and look at what the needs are and be able to tap into the services. That's certainly what I do in the African American population. We have kind of what's called a underground railroad. And so we don't have the big mainstream things, but we want to know who's doing what. And, you know, what physician our support group is all about. So where did you get your resources from? And, you know, what physician are you seeing? And what PCA service did you go with? And so, you know, it's all about getting that communication going.
Go ahead. I just want to say really quick that there's so many questions here that are going to go unanswered tonight. I you guys have given so much time already up there, but if you can, follow when you can on hashtag PolicyPint. Maybe you might be able to answer some questions that are pouring in on Twitter tonight, and maybe you'll be able to answer some things that I won't even be able to get to, because there's an awful lot of Twitter questions that I would try to incorporate. But and maybe we have a lot of resources to draw on here in our audience as well, and I would invite everyone to be part of the discussion there at hashtag PolicyPint. Eric.
So you think about Citizens League and NPR and the common good, and aging is one of those issues that I think has a great deal of hope, because it's one thing we all have in common. Everyone in this room is aging, and it interconnects with so many things, and I think that is going to, you know, the work that Larray Kanataroot has been doing as this is the coolest title in the world, Director of Aging Transformation, the work that the Canes have been doing, the work that my colleagues here have been doing and others, it's opening up new doors. That public policy issue and the financing piece have great hope that that's going to get solved, because it has to get solved. And if we're proactive about it, it's not just going to be a mandate that comes down that's built out of total crisis. There's a technology the other day that was in the Pioneer Press, and it's called Pet Chats. And it's so you can, local entrepreneurs, and they're selling it in stores across the country, so you can be at work or on vacation, and you can talk to your dog and give it a snack, and you can see each other. Well, the product that they're working on as well is a medication management product that is built off that Pet Chats platform, so that you can see that someone 30,000 miles away took medication. Well, what's the biggest cause that causes people to bounce to the emergency room and hospital stay? It's mistakes in taking medication. So these pieces, and I could go on and on technologies. Uber, out in San Diego, they have started a service for seniors and for people living with physical disabilities. And the people that are certified to drive the cars are people who want to work and bring in a person into a doctor's appointment, or go in with a person while they're grocery shopping. You know, that's a pretty cool way to look at the transportation problem. So there's going to be so many different organizations and minds that link up. It's not going to be solved by one group or by government. It's going to be multifaceted approach, and very, very hopeful and energized that Minnesota is going to be a big piece of that.
Number of things. One, transportation has come up a number of times just in the past 5 minutes, and our next policy in the Pine is going to be on transportation. Uber, public transportation, all these issues are going to dovetail very, very nicely with what we're talking about here tonight, and the discussion of seniors and transportation, I'm sure, is really going to fold into that. It's going to be in January, I believe, on the 15th. So we'll be making more announcements about that, but that's going to be the next topic. I think it certainly says an awful lot of, my God, it's just like horrifying and disgraceful that we know how to talk to our pets more than connect with our elders. But whatever can make change. Our next question.
I'm just wondering about the quality of PCA care, whether it was in the article that was in the Star Tribune about it a couple months ago, or the fact that I have several friends that have worked as PCAs. It's a $10 to $12 an hour job, and there's often no one else physically around to do the skilled nursing care that some people need. It's a way of cutting costs, it's a way of keeping people at home, but are people getting the services that they need, and is there something policy-wise that we need to do to ensure that these services that say they're giving us nursing care actually are providing the nurses instead of the $10 to $12 an hour, very disposable PCAs?
Excellent question.
That's an awesome question. And clearly from those, you know, that was a great series of articles. And clearly there's a number of people who weren't getting the services that they needed. I think increasingly tonight we've used the word system or long-term care system. I don't think it's a system at all. I think it's a bunch of fragmented elements that in some places are well coordinated, but in others suck. And I think you saw that in the Star Tribune. There were some major breakdowns there, unfathomable. And I think that's why this discussion needs to be elevated, because if we're going to preserve a safety net, then we've got to be able to deliver on that. And that's why I hate to sound like a broken record, but I think the financing piece is so critically important, because if I think that part of that ties to improving caregiver pay. I think it ties to having expanded options. I think it ties to having markets that want to develop products and services to meet the needs of those markets. I was looking today at our home care service, and I just asked a really, you know, simple question. How do people pay for this? And I got like a spreadsheet that was 23 pages long, because it was different levels of private pay. It was different, you know, 43 different insurance plans. I didn't understand it. And so when we say system, it's not a system. And so that's why I think the financing piece is just critically, critically important. Because I think, you know, we have crises like we saw in the Star Tribune article, and then we rush and pass a law in reaction to that. And we have lawmakers who had no clue that it was happening or no idea really what happens in a caregiver's life. And that's because, again, there is not a well thought out system. And I'm very hopeful that that's going to change and continue to change.
And I would just like to comment on the $10 to $12 an hour for the personal care attendant. And Eric referenced briefly the wage issue. I think while we're elevating this topic, we have to elevate the profession of caregiving in our state. $11 or $12 an hour is not a sustainable wage. If you look at caregivers in the nursing home setting, for example, most of them are women, most of them are heads of household, many of them are working two jobs. Most of them don't have health insurance themselves, even though they're providing health care services. That's not a good formula for quality, safe, well-delivered care by people who, God bless them, are willing to take care of our loved ones when we cannot.
Not to mention the fact that they may be taking care of a loved one at home themselves.
Exactly.
Because you were just saying earlier that it falls more to daughters and daughters-in-law.
Yes.
And don't we see that in action as well?
Yes, absolutely.
Playing out. All right, yeah. The next question.
Yeah, the question I have is concerning, you keep going, talking about the paying for the big picture. What about paying for the day-to-day? A lot of us that have been self-employed for years have a crisis like I did this summer. The income stops, and now you've got those expenses that come in while the crisis is, you know, the parking fee at the hospital, the cab fare to the hospital, the days that the caregivers are missing from their income. What can we do to get that initial crisis from being a bigger crisis than it really needs to be at the end, when all of a sudden you're 6 months behind on your rent and you're 6 months behind here because your income just stopped suddenly, especially if you're self-employed?
It's a great question, and that's the, you know, that's the thing that's just unfathomable to me, that our country and our state, that you can, so one of us could walk out tonight, heaven forbid, get hit by a bus, and we need, you know, might be in our 20s or 30s, and all of a sudden need care forever, and basically a family can be wiped out from that, or the situation that you're talking about. So that's what I mean when we got to have better solutions. So I don't know if that's catastrophic plan that we can buy for those pieces. I don't know if it's a fully public plan, but thankfully to Larray and Gail and others in here, there are people really thinking about that. I invite you to take, there's a booklet in back when you leave, and it's called the Pathways Booklet. And it lays out 7 different pathways to addressing these types of situations. And it lays out the pros and cons of each of them. But it's really key to starting to develop a discussion and ultimately move to answers on this, because that's the great void in our country right now. That situation shouldn't happen.
I wish that we could go on and on. I know that there are tons of people whose raised hands I was not able to get to, and also probably, 20 and 10 really, really burning questions on Twitter, too, that I wanted to try to answer. But the conversation will continue as well for whomever can chip in and keep asking the questions as well. Hashtag policy pint. And once we post the audio for this event, and we'll be letting you know when we do that, there will be a forum there at the bottom where the conversation can continue at the thecurrent.org, and we're going to try to get the audio for it up as soon as we can there as well. So, my goodness, can we first have a round of applause for our wonderful guests here tonight? Thank you guys so much for being here this evening. We really appreciate everything that you do, and your input tonight has been just really valuable and helpful and illuminating. As I mentioned, we're going to we do know what our next policy in a pint is going to be, and it is going to be in January. It's going to be on transportation. You know, I do think I have one more question actually for our guests before we go, and that is before. What is the one thing you would say to everyone as they leave tonight? What if people are going to leave here with one sort of action item? What would it be? What is the first thing that someone should consider talking about or looking up or Googling or doing, calling the legislator about? I don't know. What would you have them do?
I'm going to encourage you to Google leading age pathways. If there's not any more booklets in back, I would say leading age pathways, because that is a group of people from across the country, from all different sectors, who have said this is a problem and we need to start to engage America in solving it. And so Google leading age pathways.
And I would say, go to the Own Your Future website and work through the checklist for your age group. There's a checklist for what you should be doing to think about and plan for your own long-term care needs, depending upon where you are in your life stage.
What was it again? What was the URL?
It's Own Your Future.
Own Your Future.
Own Your Future.
And Dorothea?
I would say that caregiving is going to be, or getting very close to being, a household name. Caregiving is going to touch each and every one of us at some point in our lives. If we're not giving care, we're going to need care. And so we need to, as both of the speakers have said as well, we need to educate ourselves. We need to know what Minnesota has, what you can do to prepare yourself. So I think that this was a good start to point the finger back at ourselves and say, I need to look at this caregiving a little bit more serious and be involved in discussions such as this and policy and all. It's about us. We're all going to be caregivers or need care.
Yeah, and my gosh, I just think of one of the questions that that we didn't get to, like, what are we as individuals saving for? Like, am I saving for my own retirement or my parents' caregiving or my own caregiving? Or how do we save for all of this stuff if we're not going to be Canada yet? Dorothea Harris, Eric Schubert, and Gail Grenville, thank you so much all for being here tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Steve.
For coming.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Big ups to the Amsterdam. Thanks so much for having us again tonight. And I want to thank my producer, Jane Solinger, and from the Citizens League, Sean Kershaw, Jan Unstead, Jacob Tainter, and Pahua Hoffman. And again, there's stuff for you to check out from the Citizens League, and also that pertains to our topics here tonight at the table on the way back. And also, someone who is like the, I haven't bestowed this honor on her in a long time, but you know what's coming. The badass queen of getting it done and do it in style. The woman who's also been my right-hand woman at this this program and is half the lifeblood of it, which is Ali Lozoff, who does everything almost at NPR. Thank you very much, Ali. Thanks again for coming out tonight. #PolicyPint. See you on the radio tomorrow morning.